Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment.
I love it.
Yes, we're kicking off the show this morning with a very special guest and somebody who has lived a life in public service to folks here and across Connecticut, hailing from the home of one of our For the People radio stations down in Norwalk. I'm so pleased to welcome Connecticut's Secretary of the State, Stephanie Thomas. We'll get into a conversation about a number of mutual interests of ours between myself and the Secretary right after we remind you that the Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership, RYASAP, is reminding everybody here on this last week, end of April, that we are wrapping up Autism Acceptance Month. This is a time to celebrate the unique talents, perspectives, and contributions of individuals on the autism spectrum. It's a month dedicated to fostering understanding, compassion, and acceptance for those whose minds perceive the world differently. Autism Acceptance Month represents a shift from merely acknowledging autism to embracing and celebrating neurodiversity. So if you foster inclusive communities, we as a state can ensure that everyone, regardless of their neurotype, has the opportunity to participate fully and contribute their talents. If you'd like more information, you can visit RYASAP. Their website is thehubct.org. Secretary Thomas, welcome to the program. It's been a long journey to reach you, but we're glad we caught you on a journey between point A and point B, and we're ready to talk civics. You have spent a lifetime in service, and now as our Secretary of the State, I remember from a workshop I attended with you back in the fall, you showed a couple of pictures of your team at the Secretary of the State's office, a small but mighty crew. Just remind our listeners exactly what your office and your team is doing.
Sure. Hi. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here as I travel from point A to B. Yes, we have a small but mighty team. We do many different things at the Secretary's office, but the two things we're most well known for is we operate the business registry. So anyone who's forming an entity, they interact with our business.ct.gov portal. And then the other side of our business has to do with overseeing the administration of elections. So we work with every municipality, making sure their registrar of voters and town clerk have the training and information and some forms and paperwork that they need to implement elections around the state.
So I have to say, with the situation over the past few months in Bridgeport, you're probably on the hot list for folks in your line of work, because we kind of set some history here in Connecticut with the way that Bridgeport elections rolled out. I know our listeners who are interested read the headlines. We don't need to get into it deeply, but you are in a unique position here in the state of Connecticut in regard to voting history being made.
Yeah, you know, it highlights a lot of different things. The first thing it highlights that I think people forget, elections are administered differently in every single state. And I was, shortly after that news story broke, I was at a meeting with some other secretaries from across the country, and they were scratching their heads like, I don't get it. Like, what was the problem? Because in those states, you know, your friend, your neighbor can drop off your absentee ballot. You know, right now under Connecticut law, that is not allowed. So if I were leaving my home, ran into my neighbor and said, hey, I'm dropping off my absentee ballot, and she said, hey, can you take mine too? That is not allowed in Connecticut, but it is allowed in many states. So I like to remind people that, you know, sometimes there is confusion. Because even at the time I said, we did, during the redo of the election, we did spot check calls to people who had applied for absentee ballots to make sure You know, nothing had happened. They felt like they were able to exercise their rights free of interference, etc. And one lady struck me because she said something like, oh, yes, I vote in every election. You know, I take it very seriously. I applied. I got my ballot. I voted it. I do a lot of research. And then I gave it to that nice lady to drop off for me. So from her perspective, she had done everything right. Mm. And she did not realize she couldn't give it to the nice lady to drop off. Mm. So her rights weren't disenfranchised, but and she wasn't aware of the law saying that.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I like to remind people of these things. Of course, that was a case referred to SEEK. But, yeah, so we are in the headlines. We have had election monitors there. We've made a number of changes. We proposed some additional changes for the legislative session this year. So I do feel like we're on the right track there.
All right. Well, we'll circle back to some more important things people need to know about voting here in Connecticut in the coming primaries and the presidential election in the fall. But let's turn to another subject that's near and dear to both of our hearts, and that is civics education. You've stepped up in a big way because you, like I, view this as critically important, really kind of like the missing front tooth in the education arena, I think, in Connecticut for way too long. And unfortunately, in my view, in some ways, from communities all the way up to the state house, it's showing. We need more people that look like everybody in Connecticut to be able to feel good about stepping up and serving.
Yes, civics is certainly one of my favorite subjects, and it's part of the reason I ran for this office. And we have two sides to that. We have civic education, but also civic engagement. And I think we have conflated the term civics with politics. So you're talking about stepping up, getting involved, serving in government in some way, in an elected role. And that is one aspect of civics. But then another aspect might be learning about our rights and responsibilities as citizens of these United States. And that might be learning about, you know, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence. But there's this other side that I think most people are not tackling. And I call it civics you can use. I always think about when I was in high school, like, you know, you take algebra and, you know, all types of math. And since I've graduated, I've never had to use algebra, but I use percentages almost every day. And to me, that's civics you can use. If you want to speak up about a bill or an issue, how do you navigate the legislature? How do you find out when budget items are up for discussion? How do you find out how to get that pothole on your street fixed? These are things that no one actually teaches us, regardless of if it's taught in the school. So I've been trying to take a multi-pronged approach to addressing all aspects of that.
How are your partners on the other side of the building at the Connecticut Department of Education teaming with you in any respects to try to create an even more powerful entity of influence to get local boards of education and school districts and school systems here in Connecticut to buy in? I mean, they're starting to get the message on financial literacy. Is the next step getting the message on civics literacy, civics you can use literacy?
Yeah, State Department of Education has been great. Commissioner Russell Tucker has certainly been very responsive. They put out this year, or late last year, new standards that would incorporate civics in all grades, K through 12, which I think is a huge first step. They are between a rock and a hard place a bit in terms of adding curriculum, because every time you add something, something else is taken away. Sure. And I think that's a longer term conversation. But they have definitely partnered with us about getting the word out to like superintendents. They are also one of the sort of sponsors of our Red, White, and Blue School program, which encourages kids in classrooms to do civic projects. They get, they submit for an award. So there are many different things they're trying to do. And I think my takeaway after doing this job for slightly over a year is that it's going to take all of us doing all of this all the time. Just talking about civics around elections, I think, does our communities a disservice because civics is about so much more.
Sure. It's a 24/7 business. And to that end, and to the credit of you and your team again, you have made a situation in which it not only makes it easier for a lot more civics to get talked about in a lot of places, it actually recognizes the business and nonprofit entities that do it through something called a CEO program that I was pleased to have participated in.
Yes, thank you, CEO, and thank you for being one of our, I think you were, you must have been like one of our top 20 signers on. CEO stands for Civically Engaged Organization. And long before I ever got involved in elected roles, I owned my own business. And when I got to the secretary's office, because we handle the business registry, I started thinking about, like, what do businesses have in common with the other side of the business, elections? And I realized that every business owner I know, nonprofit founders, they all believe in community engagement. They see themselves as part of their communities. They donate, they provide volunteers, etc. So that's how the CEO program was born. It's like, can't they be proxies for us to their fill-in-the-blank employees, customers, clients, members? So every month we put together any information that everybody needs to know for like the next month, any important voter registration deadlines or like we started early voting this year. So we put out a lot of information. What is it? How does it work? What are the days? What are the hours? So we prepare social media posts, fact sheets, etc., and we send it out to our CEOs and ask that they share it with whatever community makes sense for them and that they help us do this work, actually, of incorporate talking about civics all year round. So it's entirely opt-in. Every company or organization does it very differently. We've even had a couple of towns sign on because they've said things like, hey, we can think about doing things like nonpartisan lawn signs that just talk about when an election is, or we can put up key dates on our, you know, DPW billboard sign. So there is so much creativity, I think, that has been untapped. And I think we all have a role to play in making our communities better. And our CEO program is just one of them. That's so great. I'll give a plug. It's ceopledge.ct.gov.
Fantastic. Hopefully, we'll see a little bit of a bubble of sign-ons in the next few weeks as a result of your reminder here on our program. So let's turn our attention to the other big matter of business that is always on your plate and the plate of your colleagues at the Secretary of the State's office, and that is elections. We just wrapped up kind of budget season and budget referendum season. We have already had a primary, and we are looking at some others coming up. But a lot more is changing. You did a great explanation of what was in store when I was in workshop with you back in the fall. We've now gotten to that point where early voting is happening. In your quick assessment, looking back over the few opportunities that folks had to participate in that new program here in Connecticut, how did we do stepping off the diving board for the first time on that issue?
Knock on wood, early voting went very well. You know, I am a planner, so I'm always scenario planning. What if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? How will we respond? And I'm glad to say none of those things I thought could go wrong went wrong. I consider it a success when, good news, bad news. The biggest, I won't say complaint, but part of the biggest feedback we got about what went wrong was that so few voters showed up that the computers would log out. So the election workers had to keep logging in using two-factor authentication.
Sure.
So they were like, it's taking too long. If that's the biggest complaint, I feel like we're in a good place. The bad news in that is that turnout was so low. And I think that underscores a couple of things. Obviously, it was a non-competitive race, so a lot of people didn't feel compelled to show up. But I also think there's a link between the lack of information out there, public information. A lot of just people who looked up my email address wrote to me during that period saying, hey, I just happened to be in town hall and saw a voting sign. I didn't know there was an election. How come your office doesn't do a better job about alerting the public? And I write back like, well, you can help us do a better job by writing to your legislative leaders and letting them know that you think it's important to fund public education.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now we don't receive funding for that. So we do our best using social media and smart partnerships. I speak on a lot of shows like this one to help get the word out. But I think, funding public outreach and education is of such grave importance so that our voters don't get all of their information just from political candidates. But as a state, we'll have to decide as taxpayers that that's what we want to invest in.
The taxpayer being the operative word in that last sentence has been the subject of a ton of headlines in the past few days. I guess the legislature in these final days, they look at it, I guess, as hours of the 2024 short session, is going to try to consider some sort of assistance for communities for the expenses related to these protracted, not in a bad way, but lengthier periods of voting opportunity.
Yeah, I hope so. I've been advocating for state support that would trickle down to the towns for early voting specifically, and specifically in the beginning years. Right now, it involves a lot of guesswork. Although early voting is not new, we are the 47th state to adopt it. It's new to us, so we don't know. Will we see the same number of voters just divided differently? Will a lot more people show up to vote because of the increased hours? So registrars, correctly so, are very detail-oriented people, and they want to make sure they have the staffing necessary to ensure that we don't have long lines and that everyone can vote as safely and securely and as quickly as possible. So, 5 years from now, we might have enough data that says, town X needs 5 early voting workers and maybe 7
sure.
on Saturday and Sunday. But right now, we have no idea. So
right.
They might be saying, let's go with 7 because what if? So I think having extra support from the state is not only good in terms of economy of scale for some of the things that we can produce and push down to the towns, but I think it's good for the voters as well.
Good. Well, let's take the last minute or so that we have with you Secretary Thomas, and speak right to the voters about what they need to know. We've got a primary coming up August 13th, and then the general election, the presidential election in November. What are some things that folks should be thinking about that they could do now to better prepare themselves for doing their civic duty in the primaries and in the fall?
Yes, I encourage everyone to get vote ready. Don't wait till the last minute to double check you're registered. We have a primary coming up, so make sure you're registered to the party that you want to vote for, because you have to belong to the party of the candidate to vote in a primary. So I'm just going to give some really important website links. myvote.ct.gov. That's our website, and there you can find the election calendar, so you're not ever caught by surprise about when's the last day to register, when are the elections being held, and you can check that every year because we have elections every year. And then civics101.ct.gov is a great place to go for the most common questions we get. How do college students vote? What if you're elderly and maybe need special accommodations at the poll or have a physical disability? And like, how do I find my early voting location? We have documents at that Civics 101 site that are plain language, easy to understand. They're attractive, and you can download them. You can disseminate them to community groups, et cetera. So I encourage everyone to use that information as much as they need it.
Very good. Fighting for civic education, civic engagement, and voters' rights and voter engagement. And by the way, Connecticut businesses, she and her team have your back as well. I'm talking about Secretary of the State of Connecticut, Stephanie Thomas. She has been kind enough to spend some time chatting with us this morning here on For the People. Secretary Thomas, a pleasure. Hopefully we'll chat again a week or two after the primaries, and we'll give you another opportunity to remind folks as we ramp up toward the presidentials in the fall. Thank you so much for your time today.
Anytime, John. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Well, as we reach the midpoint in the program, the middle of the road of this week's award-winning For the People, it's only appropriate that we bring in some other close friends of ours who are always keeping us up to speed on things going on the road. Alex, sorry about that. I didn't mean that second one. It just comes out of me. Alex Slacky is with us from AAA Northeast, and there's a lot to talk about in terms of things going on our roadways. It's never good news when anybody loses their life in a traffic collision, but there are some shocking statistics that have been emerging. Probably one of the most of concern for me, a new and fledgling e-bike owner who's got all the protection a helmet and 300 plus pounds can offer, pedestrian safety and cyclist safety. So before we went on the air, Alec and I were just reviewing some statistics, and the one that really kind of blows us both away, and not just us, but law enforcement and traffic safety advocates all over the country, is almost an 80% increase in pedestrian deaths in the decade between 2010 and 2021. Compared to a 25% increase in all of the traffic fatalities. Alec, this has triggered, obviously, a lot of attention from AAA, from your Traffic Safety Science Institute, also on the part of AAA Northeast in your office. Let's talk a little bit and start the conversation today, trying to do whatever we can to help our pedestrians and bicyclists and cyclists here in Connecticut be a little bit safer, if that's even possible.
It's really a challenging issue that's vexing policymakers across the country. And I think there are a variety of reasons why we're seeing this trend. We know that, you know, when our roads were built back in the 50s and 60s, when people were starting to see cars be more popular and more garages, the priority was getting a vehicle from A to B as quickly as possible. And safety was not nearly at the forefront in the way that it is today. But it's a big effort to try to redesign those roads to make it optimal for pedestrians and cyclists and vehicles, because the research that we show, we're AAA, our members by and large drive cars. We want everyone to be safe. And we see that when we do redesign roads for safety, when we have things like road diets, where maybe instead of two lanes in each direction, it's one lane in each direction, and with a turn lane in the middle, traffic might actually flow better because it's more regulated and clearer where people are supposed to go, and people in cars are also safer. So it's something that we've got to work on, but it's a big investment that's going to have to be done across the country. Mm.
I remember back in the early to mid 80s in my time in Los Angeles, when many of my days were spent in the moving parking lot that is the 405 freeway and the 10. Discussion back then was the surest way to fill an additional lane of traffic is to build an additional lane of traffic. So that sort of begs the question of when communities are now much more aggressively looking at taking steps like the one you just described of taking two lane roads down to one, or taking roads with very wide shoulders where there might be a lot of passing on the right and passing on the left outside the actual travel lane, and making them smaller with bump outs and other calming measures. Where is all that extra traffic going to go? Is it just going to go slower? Is it going to back up? How does AAA see communities dealing with the combination of making these traffic mitigation and speed mitigation measures and then dealing with where all this traffic is going to go?
It's a tough problem, and you're right that when we see that induced demand effect where you have another lane and there's just more traffic to fill it. So it's not like we want one lane roads everywhere. Obviously, people need to get where they're going, and we want people to be moving around and helping the economy grow. But a lot of times, you can try to mitigate those issues with targeted, signal timing changes, or maybe a turn lane is extended. A lot of times the traffic issues are very localized. I mean, of course, if sometimes there's just more traffic and you can't mitigate 100% of it, but there are ways that you can try to improve particular hotspots that people know are problems in their communities. And that's best done really at the community level, because people are going to know, hey, this intersection, really, we should have three more seconds for a left turn lane because it really backs up. Or I wish this turn lane were extended back another, 100 feet, because it would be easier for me to get in. Those sorts of changes are things that people, really should have a voice about. And I'm glad that communities are getting these safety investments from the federal government, state government, to try to work on these things.
Yeah. Well, let's turn our attention to cyclists, because if part of the issue is distracted driving and the, kind of the complexity of infotainment centers that are drawing people's attention maybe a little bit more longer away from the job at hand, and that's watching the road and the pedestrians and cyclists on it. Let's start with cyclists. Is AAA advising any type of, boilerplate behaviors that cyclists could take, or is saving more cyclists just going to mean creating more other vehicle, restricted pathways and rail to trails and things like that, where motorized vehicles, cars, and trucks aren't allowed?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are certainly good ideas that you mentioned at the end, but we know those those often take a long time, and we don't want to wait to keep people safe. And I'm glad you mentioned distracted driving, because it's something that we think about when you look at why pedestrians and cyclists are so much more at risk than they were 10, 15 years ago. We talk about the roads. The roads haven't changed in the last 15 years. What has changed? The vehicles and the drivers and driver behavior, especially distracted driving, speeding. You know, it's really gotten worse during the pandemic, and it never really came back to what it was before. So we've got to make sure we get people to put the phone down, especially, you know, when we see crashes among driver traveling in the same direction as a cyclist. You know, there's a good chance that the driver just didn't see the cyclist. And why was that? Because I would bet there's a decent chance that they were looking at a phone or distracted by, you know, someone else in the car. Maybe it was they were, you know, reaching down to pick something up that they dropped. Who knows? But we've got to make sure we improve driver behavior. And I think, you know, enforcement is certainly a big part of that.
Yeah. Well, also, we haven't ventured into the potential that some of these deaths are being caused, unfortunately, by impaired drivers. So with that in mind, let's switch gears to another area that you're paying very close attention to and have been since January, as we get into the last week or so of the 2024 Connecticut General Assembly session. There are a couple measures that are percolating. Perhaps the outcome of them may have even changed between the time we tape this at noon hour on Friday and it plays on Sunday morning, or people are listening to it on the podcast during next week. But what's cooking at the State House?
You talk about impaired driving, and I'm sure a lot of folks have read about the effort to lower the blood alcohol concentration limit from 0.08 to 0.05. And this is something that is an emerging traffic safety trend, I guess you could call it that, or traffic safety effort in the U.S. So far, only Utah has a 0.05 limit, but it's something that's pretty common in countries around the world. Most of our peer countries economically have limits of 0.05 or lower. And it's something that, you know, whether or not it passes, and look, we know it's an uphill battle in the legislature. That's not surprising. It's going to be an uphill battle in any legislature, but we want to get the point across that 0.05 is impaired. Certainly, you know, would I rather get in a car with someone that's 0.05, or would I rather get in a car with someone that's 0.15? I'd rather be in the car with someone that's 0.05, but I'd much rather neither of them be on the road at all. Yeah. And we know there's plenty of research that shows that, you know, a variety of motor functions are impaired at 0.05. You're more likely to be in a crash or a fatal crash at 0.05. And we would just rather people separate drinking from driving entirely. If you're planning to drink, don't drive. And if you're planning to drive, don't drink. And you know, I don't want to just take it back to the old designated driver, but you know, we've got ride hailing apps, you know, Uber and Lyft.
Oh, sure.
Some folks that can use transit, and you know what? I encourage people to go out and have a drink. Connecticut's got great breweries, great wineries. Go out and enjoy. I certainly have. But you know, maybe when it's your turn to not drive, go out and enjoy a mocktail or some other drink, and you know, you can help your friends and family get around, and then they can return the favor for you.
Very good. Let's give you a break, folks. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about another important group of folks at risk, those working on Connecticut highway and roadway work sites, as well as a little bit about what's going on with electric vehicle trends here in Connecticut and gas prices. What's going on? I remember back in the, at Christmas time, I was paying $2.97. Now it's almost approaching $3.97, big jump in gas prices. We'll talk more about that as well as a little bit of good news, maybe, if you're doing some air traveling. We'll be back with Alex Slacky from AAA Northeast in just a moment. But in the meantime, we want to remind you that our friends in Literacy, Read to Grow, want you to know that there are only a few tickets left for their event, A Night for Books Literacy Champion Awards and Fundraiser. It's happening May 2nd at the Westport Library. You can delight in tasty food and drinks inspired by children's picture books, connect with new acquaintances, raise your paddle to support the cause, and engage in some thrilling games. You can help honor the Read to Grow Literacy Champions and meet their inaugural Book Joy Award recipient, Michelle Threets. You can get tickets and learn how to support this important literacy nonprofit by visiting readtogrow.org. So, Alex, let's turn our attention to the folks who help make the roads better, literally, these work crews on the sides of the roads. We've seen way too many crashes, not just involving the folks that are doing the work on the roadways, but the troopers and the police officers and flaggers that are trying to help protect them.
100%. And we, you know, we've seen DOT really prioritize enforcement and work zones, and particularly automated enforcement. And for the last year, there was a pilot program where at a few particular work zone locations, DOT put in cameras. And, you know, I'm certainly someone that would tell you, hey, if I thought these automated enforcement cameras were about money, I would tell you they're not. Because DOT says, hey, first time we catch you going you know, more than 15 miles over the speed limit in a work zone, we're going to give you a warning. And then the second time is a fine. And so it's really, you got to be working hard to actually have gotten a ticket. You've got to be really speeding dangerously and frequently. And we saw the results pay off. You can look at these graphs in DOT's report and literally see the speed shift from before they put the cameras into after, where there's a lot fewer people that are speeding. And we don't want anyone to get tickets. And we want this program to be reauthorized. And we don't see it as a moneymaker. We see it as a way to keep the folks that are working on our roads and helping us get from A to B safe. And I think, you know, I think the legislature will hopefully prioritize this one in the waning days of session and make sure that we can, you know, keep those folks safe. And I think there's, you know, what I saw in the Transportation Committee is bipartisan support for this effort, which is not surprising. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get that one reauthorized and keep folks safe on the roads ahead.
Great. And our last 5 minutes or so with Alex Slacky from AAA Northeast, we've got a couple more issues to cover. Alec, it's been in the news this week on a kind of a global level. Tesla is announcing massive layoffs in the face of a downtrend in sales. And here in Connecticut, we're hearing about at least one major energy utility making changes in a rebate program for EV home charging stations. AAA, to your credit and your employer's credit, is not only you keeping an eye on these trends and reporting on them, you're actually going one step further and going all 21st century on us here by by putting an electric charging emergency response vehicle pilot program together. That's awesome.
Yeah, we're trying, because we know, you know, our members are out there in plenty of gas-powered cars and plenty of electric cars. And for gas-powered cars, you run out of gas and we'll give you a gallon and get you going to the next gas station. And we want to make sure we can do something similar for people that have electric cars. And we've always been able to service electric cars, right? We will, if you're out of charge, we'll tow you to the nearest charging station. So we've always been able to help, but we, you know, certainly people would prefer to get a charge right there, assuming it's safe, right? If you're on the side of an interstate, you ran out of charge, we're not going to spend, you know, 15 minutes on the side of the interstate waiting to charge you up. We're going to get you out of there and get you to a safe place.
Sure.
But what we found, interestingly, is that we've got this pilot in 25 regions around the country, including Connecticut. the interest in it hasn't been huge because what we're finding is most electric vehicle owners, they are managing their charging appropriately, and they're not getting to a place where they're running out of charge. I remember, I mean, my dad, he's still driving a gas-powered car, but when we grew up, he would always get it down very close to empty, and I was late to my own birthday party one time because we ran out of gas, and it's always a fun family story. But we're seeing that because the EV owners now tend to be the more early adopters, they're more interested in, you know, EVs as a technology, they're very engaged and they're not letting the cars run out. What we're seeing for the electric cars is the same things we're seeing for gas-powered cars. People having tire issues, flat tire.
Right.
You got tires on every sort of car. Right. We're going to help with that.
Yeah, other mechanical stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, good. Well, hey, we've got about 2 minutes left with you, Alec. Let's end the show with good news, hopefully, for travelers on airlines. Big news out of US DOT earlier this week on ways to make it easier for air travelers to get refunds that they're entitled to.
Yeah, and you know, I appreciate that. It's always good to talk about good news because so often we're talking about not good news on the roads.
Exactly.
And you know, I like to talk about good news when we have it. And this DOT rule really makes it easier and streamlines the process for when people are entitled to refunds from airlines. DOT is saying this has got to be done automatically, right? You don't want to make consumers jump through hoops. So let's say your flight is canceled. And then maybe there's an alternative that they give you. It's the next day. You're trying to get to a wedding or graduation or job interview, and it's too late and it's not of value to you. You should be able to get a refund for that flight, but you shouldn't have to jump through a million hoops to do that. And I think that's what the DOT rule really does, is to tell the airlines, hey, you've got to do this automatically, right? You can give someone the option for an alternative transportation, you know, an alternative flight. If they tell you no, then you got to give the money back right away or within, you know, within a reasonable time frame.
You can't make the
consumer fill out forms and go through a million hoops to get that money back that they're entitled to. And I think that's good. I mean, it's not going to cover every situation, right? If your flight is delayed by an hour and you miss a connection, and then you got to stay in a hotel in that connecting city, this is not necessarily going to cover you. That's where something like travel and insurance could help. But
of course,
it does make I think it's going to make a big difference and make a lot of folks' lives a little bit easier.
Excellent. Well, from happy travels, safe travels, hopefully, on our roadways here in Connecticut and wherever you may be listening to us, to air travelers and folks in their EVs and everyone in between. Alec Slacky is Managing Director for Public and Government Affairs for AAA Northeast. They'd love for you to consider being part of their network if you're inclined. You can go to AAANortheast.com to find out about everything that they offer to travelers and others here in Connecticut and beyond. They would love to have you as part of their team. Alec, thank you so much for our conversation today, and we'll be talking to you again soon. As we start heading toward the end of our morning, we're going to replay our first interview of the new year from back in January with CHDI, the Child Health and Development Institute. But before that, we want to remind you that May is National Foster Care Month. It's an annual observance to recognize and support children, youth, and families in the foster care system. To that end, Wheeler's foster care team serves youth and families in Waterbury and 8 surrounding towns to provide youth aged 6 to 17 with stable, safe, caring environments for shorter periods of time or potentially longer. Wheeler's foster care program uses the evidence-based functional therapy foster care model that helps youth in foster care and their families develop skills for lifelong success. To learn more about the program and becoming a foster parent through Wheeler, just visit wheelerhealth.org/foster. And as promised, we have brought back an organization that has just been a tremendous resource to our program and listeners. And I'm excited to welcome a new member of that organization to the Greater For the People family. We are here with Dr. Gina Bracey. She's Associate Vice President for Schools and Community Initiatives for CHDI, the Child Health and Development Institute. Gina, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us, and thanks for being the next in a long litany of fantastic guests here on our program.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate the invitation to come and share our work with you. And as always, we at CHDI love having an opportunity to talk with you and share with your listeners all the great things we're doing over here.
So folks, especially those who have students in their lives, are going to be hearing a lot more about this first of two initiatives we're going to be talking about. And it is so exciting and important because we've been talking so much over the past decade about the really the crisis in mental health with our younger people here in Connecticut and across the country. Perhaps it is even a global phenomena, but thanks to the folks at CHDI and you, the state of Connecticut has launched Connecting Schools to Care for Students. This initiative will integrate trauma-informed and comprehensive school mental health supports into existing community-based networks of care. And so beyond that brief introduction, let's first remind people what CHDI even is all about and your role in it with the school and community initiatives piece of it.
Yes, absolutely. So at CHDI, or the Child Health and Development Institute, we work really statewide across Connecticut to improve the behavioral health and well-being of children, youth, and families. So our goal is really to work at the systems level to advance effective practice and policy solutions that result in equitable and optimal behavioral health and well-being for children and their families. So we work together with many partners across the system in terms of state agency partners, local community-based providers, schools, pediatric primary care, the full system of care across Connecticut to make sure that the services are accessible and that they get the best quality outcomes for students.
Yeah, the thing that I've always admired about CHDI and your means of operation is that you bring all the treetops together, you engage both the policy makers and doers face-to-face with and often in the same place as the individuals who are going to be served by them. And this program appears to also check that box. Tell us about the development of this Connecting Schools to Care for Students initiative.
Yes, absolutely. I'm really excited to talk about this initiative. So this has been several years in the making, and we actually call it Connect 4 for short, and that's because it's the fourth round of Connect or Connecting to Care funding for the state of Connecticut. And so this is using federal funds that's awarded to the Department of Children and Families. And our organization, CHDI, works as the coordinating center statewide for the implementation of this grant. And so where we are with this year and this round of the grant, as you mentioned, is really to focus much more intensively on schools. And as you started, you know, this conversation, talking about how intensive the needs are, how much more aware I think we are of the needs that students are showing up to schools with and what the capacity of schools are to actually manage those challenges and or to connect with their community-based partners to help, you know, do that in a collaborative way is really important. And so this opportunity over the next 4 years really gives us a chance to build on the work that has been done over the past several years, multiple rounds of this grant in Connecticut to build up the statewide system of care. So again, every aspect that of a child's life that they touch, so from school, education, from the healthcare system to juvenile justice for kids that have that level of involvement, and that full spectrum. So anyone that's really involved in a child's life, what's the best way to kind of make sure that those services, that those supports are integrated and that they are equitable and that they result in strong positive outcomes for those children and their families? And so, again, we're looking at the opportunity to focus more directly on schools to help them be this, a very strong part of that system. So oftentimes kids are first identified at school. Sometimes the challenging behaviors might show up in school, or even it can look at as kids with being withdrawn or just showing difficulty engaging in the classroom. And so for that full spectrum of kids, what's the best way for them to access care? And what's the role of the school in that whole process? And so that's really kind of in a nutshell what this is all about.
So can you tell me a couple of the most successful components of the prior cycles of the system of care awards that will, serve as a solid foundation as you move forward to initiate the four key goals of the current Connect Four initiative?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the using the systems of care values and principles, which are, again, kind of a nationally recognized framework for community-based services to be most efficient, effective, to serve kids in their homes and communities, sort of least restrictive settings possible, to invoke their cultural backgrounds and language backgrounds and needs. Those are kind of the key values and principles that all of this work has looked to integrate and to support and improve over these past few years. And so, you know, one key outcome of that has been to make sure that parents and youth and families themselves are engaged in that decision-making process. And so that's one of the key foundations of this work, is making sure that they're at all the decision-making tables from their local community up to the state level, where policies and practices are being decided, that families and consumers have a strong voice in leading that discussion and leading what happens to them. So it's not just to them, but it's with them. And then another key piece is really around making sure that services are equitable and appropriate, and that they are really, really speak to the cultural and linguistic needs of families. And so one of the other key successes of the previous the work that's built this foundation is helping communities and providers kind of understand, to kind of assess what their population looks like, who are those that are in need, who are those that are getting services and accessing services, and how can we strengthen the services in a way that meet their own needs in terms of their cultural and linguistic needs, that then help them to engage most effectively and get the best outcomes from those services. So I'd say those are two really key components to highlight from the previous rounds of this work.
So the kind of funding to deliver these phases of the Connect program, they don't keep coming unless there is proven positive outcomes. How are we doing as a state, given the implementation of the first three phases of Connect, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, where is access to the system improving? And so are more kids who need specific services, are they able to access those across the community? And so that's something we definitely look at increasing over time. And then quality is a huge piece of this work as well. So do we, you know, how does the quality improve? Are we looking at getting kids into services faster? Are they more appropriate services that meet exactly kind of what their needs are? Are they easily accessible for families in terms of transportation or, you know, being cost effective and efficient in that way? And again, ultimately, are kids getting better? And so those are where we're definitely seeing positive outcomes in each of those areas to continue to kind of sustain and build upon that effort as we move forward. And I think, you know, there's always more work to be done, of course. And but I think to see those gains kind of year over year, and to see more students or more children and youth benefiting from the service system is ultimately what we're looking for.
Very good. If you're joining us here for this first interview of 2024, we're with Dr. Gina Bracey. She's Associate VP for School and Community Initiatives at CHDI, the Child Health and Development Institute. They have been a long and a regular resource to us here on For the People, so it was appropriate that we invite them in for this very first discussion of the new year, especially in a year where we'll all probably be turning more of our attention to taking better care of the mental health of our youngest state residents. CHDI has just initiated the fourth phase of their Connect initiative and is going to be utilizing Connecticut's established framework for trauma-informed comprehensive school mental health to address four key goals in the coming year and course of this program. Before we turn our attention to the Connect for Families toolkit, Dr. Bracey, what's the last word you can leave parents and interested listeners with in regards to the Connect for initiative? When will they be hearing more about it from the front lines in their child's own school or community environment?
That's absolutely our number one goal for this first year of the grant, is to disseminate information widely to all 206 public school districts in Connecticut, as many of those as we can get to this year, to share information about what is this sort of comprehensive school mental health approach that we are looking to implement and expand statewide, and what's available to them currently. And so there definitely will be hearing information soon about all of that. And we always have information sort of readily available on our website at any point as well.
And folks that are listening can get right on to CHDI.org and connect to the Connect for Families toolkit, which has been around and also has provided some great success. Let's turn our focus to that in the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have.
Yes, absolutely. We're so excited to share this resource that recently came out of this initiative, and it is available on our website. We also have the planforchildren.org website where you can find this information and more about the whole Connecting to Care initiative. But this product itself, the toolkit product, was a partnership between us and Department of Children and Families, who I'd mentioned, as well as Carillon Behavioral Health, FAVOR, Family Advocacy Organization, and the Consultation Center at Yale, who serves as the evaluator for this initiative. And together, we really found a need to kind of have a one-stop shop for families, but also providers and community members to help understand, how do I find mental or behavioral health services for kids and families in my community? How do I access that information? If I'm a provider, how do I actually communicate and collaborate well with other providers, whether that be other behavioral health providers or primary care providers? What's one way to sort of bring all that information together in a really easy, accessible kind of place? And so that was the impetus behind developing this online toolkit. So it is online. And one other reason for making sure that it's online is that we can then update it more easily. There are lots of links in this toolkit. There are several different sections. There's many ways to sort of navigate between sections and pages. It's very user-friendly. And it gives 6 overall sections to help users kind of understand the system and navigate the system a little bit more effectively. And so just to quickly highlight those sections, there are 6 sections. One is finding behavioral health services and supports. So where do you start? Where do you go? The second gives you the why, the what, the how, the when, all of those pieces around effective collaboration. Mm-hmm. Again, how do you work well together? The third section is on electronic tools to support collaboration. So electronic medical records, those kinds of things. There's a section on confidentiality and how to go through the consent process to share information or restrict sharing information that you don't want to share. Tips from parents specifically and youth and providers for each other around how to effectively collaborate. And then the final section is more designed for providers, but just kind of understanding that evolving coding and billing landscape, because there's a lot of complicated information out there. And how do you kind of digest all of that and use that in a most effective way? Fantastic. That's kind of a highlight of the toolkit overall.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you taking time to talk with us this morning. Our guest has been Dr. Gina Bracey. She's Associate Vice President for School and Community Initiatives for the Child Health and Development Institute, CHDI. We talk about them and feature their team a lot on our program because they're doing great work here in Connecticut, bridging a better and more equitable behavioral health and well-being initiatives for children, youth, and families here. We thank you, Doctor, Happy New Year, and we look forward to the next steps and our next visit with CHDI.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.